Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. So this week, we watched Foe. Here is your synopsis. Hen and Junior farm a secluded piece of land that has been in Junior's family for generations, but their quiet life is thrown into turmoil when an uninvited stranger shows up at their door with a startling proposal. This film stars Saoirse Ronan, Paul Mescal, and Aaron Pierre, and is directed by Garth Davis. So, Dale, what are your thoughts?
This reminds me very much of, you know, the problem I had with Goldfinch, because it was a story I was really, like, a movie I really wanted to see at the time. And this gave me the same vibe. It's literally the same thing, almost. Like, it was a hit book, but then the theatrical adaptation falls short of what the book was. And yes, all that's my, like, that's really, like, I got what I wasn't expecting from, you know, Garth Davis. Like, Saoirse, Paul, they acted their butt off in this, but it wasn't giving what I was expecting.
Yeah, this was an interesting watch. Yeah, interesting. So I definitely feel like this is a movie that you have to watch more than once. Like, I had to do that. First, like, when I was watching it and I finished it, I said, I don't know what I just watched. And then I watched an interview with Garth Davis, and when he explained it, I said, okay, I think I understand what you're doing. And so I had to go back and watch it again just to pick up and see, like, okay, let me try to connect the dots and make sense of this. I will say that, like, even after watching it twice, which I normally don't do, but because this was so confusing to me, I had to do it. I don't know. I feel like if you're adapting a book to film, like, the audience shouldn't have to do this much work to understand what it is. I mean, some people have said that it was very predictable, so, like, they got it immediately. But I guess for my little brain, it took a longer time to figure out what this was, and to kind of try to piece everything together. And I don't know. I feel like it took too much effort. And I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah. Like, it was like, in the beginning, they kind of do a little blurb saying, you know, robots and AI, like, replace menial tasks. And at that point, you're just thinking, oh, it's just going to be, you know, the current trend of AI sci-fi movies, just in the backdrop of people owning a farm. And literally, like, if you don't pay attention to, like, that scene, like, that blurb at the beginning, you'll literally miss the whole point of the movie. Because when I, like, before I actually sat down and processed the movie, like, like, halfway through, I was like, oh, I kind of figured, like, oh, spoiler, one of them was replaced. And I assumed initially, you know, based on how, like, the first, like, 10 minutes were was basically a marriage where the woman is no longer interested, where both sides, like, it's amicable differences, but they're still fighting. And then it revolves into, oh, she falls in love with the robot, and then, you know, it actually is a story of a marriage that has fallen apart at the end, where somebody actually is replaced at the end. It was a very convoluted way to get to that point. You know, the sci-fi esque of it all really did not, it really wasn't necessary in the story of a relationship that's falling apart, you know? Like, we've seen so many other movies have last couple years do that very well. Like we see a lot of creators and, you know, our age groups are actually processing their issues with relationships, familial trauma, stuff like that, through their art. And I feel like the sci-fi part was really hackly thrown in and didn't fit, and the movie would have fine without the element.
Yeah, I feel like the thing is, like, I love movies where it's like, we're using science fiction to understand human beings. Like, that's my stuff right there. Like, I love that. I love the sci-fi genre overall anyways, but I like it when it's stripped down like this and more like personal, and like you're seeing someone's relationship develop over or disintegrate over time. And I feel like when we were focusing on the relationship, those are the pieces of it that I liked the most. I think that when we tried to incorporate the science fiction stuff, that's when things got a little muddy for me. I'll just say that. Like, because I don't know. I feel like there were so many elements set up where this movie could have done really well. Like, Saoirse and Paul have amazing chemistry. The performances were good overall. I feel like they are actors who I prefer to see in not doing very loud performances, if you know what that means, where, like, there's a lot of screaming, a lot of, like, it's basically like that scene in Marriage Story where Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver are, like, fighting in his apartment, but that is the movie. Like, it's not a scene, it's the entire film.
The whole movie,
So, I'm not a huge fan of that kind of storytelling. I just don't think that, I think in terms of, like, revealing emotions and stuff, that it has to be paced very well, just because you can oversaturate audiences when you're just doing a lot of big emotions. It just kind of gets exhausting towards the end. And towards the end, I was exhausted. So, and I think that Saoirse and Paul actually suit a more subtle type of acting style. I just think that the characters that they've played over the years have been much more refined. And so when you do get those big emotional moments, it feels that much more powerful. So it felt a little weird kind of watching them cry and scream for like an hour and 40 minutes. It was weird. But I will say that their chemistry is still really good. Yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously they're like two of the best actors of their generation. Like, they're really great. It's just, and Aaron Pierre as well. I don't want to, like, he was great in this. Like, I only saw him in Old, and then he died, and that movie was a joke. So, like, I'm very happy to see him in something else. I know people have their feelings about this movie, and I do too, but I think that his performance was great as well. So, like, I liked what they were bringing to it. I think as really great actors, they brought as much as they could to the material, but I just feel like there were just certain elements in it that just turned me off, I guess. Like, I wasn't as in, I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. So
and it's disappointing the amount of effort and work we went to, like, looking for this movie, because we were both excited for it. You know, it released in, like, you know, here in, like, October, and then we could not find it in theaters at all until it popped up online, and now you have the opportunity. Like, the amount of effort we went to look for this movie to be rewarded with what we got is, like, so sad. Like, Saoirse and Paul, like, you're right. I think they're actors who do very well with muted situations. This very much is, like, this style of acting reminded me very much of, what's that movie with Julia Roberts? And it was, like, Thanksgiving at the family.
August, Osage County.
August, Osage County. Like, where it's just loud the whole time. But it worked in that movie because it was also a bit of a comedy as well. You know, but this is, like, so dramatic and so serious where we can't sit in those quiet moments with the characters. Like, it's just a mile a minute. And then there's a bit of, like, weirdly, I apologize if I take it that way, a bit of a twinge of, like, homoerotic play between Paul Mescal's character and Aaron Pierre to a degree. And I remember reading an article about this movie because Langfield Stanfield was originally cast in the role of Terrence, but he dropped. But he dropped out before shooting started, and they replaced him with Aaron. And people were wondering, like, how, and I'm also wondering now how he would have played that role over Aaron, because Aaron kind of does it almost he brings a slight villainous twinge to it, mm-hmm. which really ruins the twist at the end to a degree, because he's been kind of playing a villain the whole time. Whereas what we've seen from Lankeith is Lankeith's performances can be very dry and subtle. So, like, the expectation of the twist, probably if Lankeith was performing that role, probably wouldn't have been as obvious near the end or near the penultimate act of the movie, you know? So okay. That's one of those things I'm kind of, like, wondering how that could have played. I really wish they keyed in a bit more of, you know, the environmental aspect of it, because it's clear that his attachment to the farm, and she is basically saying, there's nothing here, they're burning farmland, let's leave. But he's still, like, I wish there was that kind of duality still there at play. Because it's a sci-fi movie, they're trying to incorporate modern day issues of climate change and, you know, corporations taking over people's land and AI. Like, they could have done, like, a little bit more with them wrestling with the issue of the farm and why he refused to leave, even though there's nothing there as well.
Yeah. Okay, so the actual plot, right? So
yeah,
basically when you start the film, Aaron Pierre's character, who's like working for this government that sends people into space, comes to Saoirse and Paul's house, right?
Yeah.
And there had this conversation about Paul going to space and all of that, and then he comes to stay with them, and then you find out later, because like a whole bunch of weird stuff ends up happening where he's like seeing people and things like that, but you don't know if like you're actually seeing what he's seeing or if he's just like imagining things. And then we get the twist, which is like, actually this is the replica, the real husband has been in space this entire time and now he's back. And then once they kill the replica, the original husband and wife are back together, she's still miserable, and then I guess at the end she leaves because she has her own replica, which ends up being with the original husband. Yeah. And I was like, when did we decide that? Like, how did we get here? Did she talk about this originally? And maybe she did. Like, when I watched it again, Aaron Pierre was saying like, oh, if you need help or something, like, I got you, basically. I'm rephrasing his words, but like, so was that the link of like, okay, she made a replica and the replica is now with the, like, I get it. Like, she just wanted to leave and I'm glad that she did, because honestly, the husband sucked. But like, I don't know. I feel like there were so many things that just didn't make sense to me, or like it made sense, but like, I don't like how we got there. Like, I don't like the journey of us getting to this point. And also, I will just say, like, some of the dialogue wasn't great. Like, there's a part where they're killing Replica Junior, and she was like, this can never be forgiven. It's like, what? Who?
That's, you know, like, he wasn't real. Like,
okay. And this is why I'm glad that we have this podcast, because I have questions, and I'm so glad that we get to, like, dissect this. What point did she not know that they were going to kill him? Because she knew that he was a replica. Like, that when the first scene that we see is her crying in the shower, and it's not because she's in a miserable marriage, it's because she has to live with this replica, and like the real husband is gone and she doesn't want to have sex with it or whatever, because she's like, what is it? It's AI, like, it's not even a person, right? So my question is like, okay, so she knows that it's a replica. How did she think this was going to play out? She was kind of complicit in most of it. Am I reading that completely wrong? I don't know.
And it's not just that. And how she describes, it's like, she doesn't even describe the robot itself. She is describing their relationship. Like, oh, he doesn't see me anymore, I don't think he wants to talk to me anymore, that kind of thing. Like, but then we see when they switch, like, we clearly saw the robot was mad attentive. He was like, I don't want to leave you alone. I would want to go to space. I don't want to leave you. I want to be here with you. And she's fighting him, forcing him to leave. Like, that's complete opposite of the diatribe she went in the beginning about how her husband doesn't love her and all that kind of stuff. Like, clearly the robot even went to her job, like, well, let's just leave. Let's spend the day together. Let's enjoy it. If I have to go, I want to be with you. And then Paul comes home and is like, oh, you cheated on me with a robot. Mm. And she's like, what? You left him here for that purpose, so I wouldn't be alone. And it's And the only reason I realized she was replaced, it wasn't the scene at the end where she's flying off in the plane.
No, yeah, it's not. It's earlier.
It's earlier. I realized that she was replaced after, like, it was a sudden character change from the scene where they're in the rain and she's happy, and then he leaves, she's downtrodden, to the next scene is like, oh, I'll get you a beer. Like, that was a real rapid switch in characterization. But the only reason, real reason I knew it was a robot is because they went back to the Beetle dialogue of where Paul's replica was focused on the Beetle where they found it on the closet. And then she goes, oh, I've never seen one of those before. Mm. And Paul just accepts it, crushes the Beetle, and goes out with the robot happy as hell. Mm. You know?
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, and I was saying, and I find that characterization from him in the end is weird because he viewed her actions as cheating, but now he's like, oh, I have the wife I want, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah. And is it cheating if it's with you? Like, it's just, but just like a replica, like not really, but, and again, like you said, bad, you agreed to that. Like,
yeah.
When you went into space, like, that's what you were agreeing to. But I guess I'm wondering, because like, that whole climax of the movie where the replica, he finds out that he is the replica and they kill him. That whole sequence, like, I think Aaron Pierre's character says something to the effect of like, oh, well, Hen didn't know all of it. I didn't tell her. So my question is like, okay, what did she know and when did she know it? Because she knew it was a replica and she was kind of play acting. Even when he got hurt, she was like, oh no, you did this. Like, you ran into the fire. No one hurt you. She's like lying to him. Because if she tells him the truth, like, oh, by the way, you are not my husband. Like, you are just a replica. That would have ruined, I don't know, the experiment. Maybe the replica would have killed itself. I don't know. But I just feel like, why was she like crying, like going off? Like, I know she fell in love with it, but I'm just wondering, like, you knew that real husband's coming back home. So how did you think that this scenario was going to end? Like, did you think that you guys were going to run off together and they weren't going to catch you? Like, I'm just wondering, because I think her reaction was so intense. And I'm just like, but you knew what was going on this entire time. It's not like you were out of the loop. So I'm confused about that. I'm also confused about, like, why is the husband still such a douche when he comes back home? Like, it's just, there were just questions. I feel like the only way I'm going to get them answered is if I actually read the book, which I think I might do, because I think that the book is probably way better than this. And I want answers, because I feel like I've invested too much in this movie to not know what the people's motivations were. I guess that's my thing. Like, I kind of get hers. Like, I know she's unsatisfied and she wants to leave. And I guess his motivation is like, well, this is my life and I'm not going to change it for anyone, not even you. So I guess that's just where they're at. And they don't, like, I wonder if she ever considered staying, or maybe seeing the value in staying in the farm and like fixing the marriage or whatever, or like, at least being a part of the, or trying to fix it. I don't know how much you can do if the other person isn't willing to do anything. And I wonder how much he was ever, if he ever thought about actually leaving. Or if his mind was just set. Like,
I mean,
I will just stay here.
He clearly says, like, oh, this is my family. You know, my family's buried in the backyard. That kind of thing. Like, he has some kind of attachment to the farm. But I also think after a while, she viewed the replacement, the robot replacement, as a... as basically marriage therapy for herself. You know, at a certain point, she starts playing the piano again, and the robot is now engaged in her playing the piano and stuff like that. They're outside working. Like, he's like, oh, I don't want you wearing that shirt again. And she's like, well, I wear that shirt all... I like the shirt I wear all the time. He's like, because that shirt is the same shirt you wore when I first met you, and I don't want it getting messed up. Like, he's holding sentimental value onto stuff, and that helps her realize what she's lacking in her actual real husband. You know, which I find that very interesting. My thing I find very confused is, were those corporations that he assumed were burning the farms always the people who were watching his, I guess, the AI itself? Because remember, at the end of the movie, when he tries to shoot them, they attack him and put, like, a tracking tag on him.
Right.
You know, So I'm wondering, are those, like, the corporation the whole time who are burning the farms but also keeping track of the robots and whatnot? And I don't like the ending where they actually shut the robot down, because they play it as if it's a funeral scene. And it becomes, and it essentially is, but it's so eerie and off-putting, because you see a bunch of people we have never seen this movie before in, like, suits and stuff, sitting down watching, like, this man beg and die, beg for his life not to die, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah. And I hope the book is better, but, you know, the writer of the book, Ian Reid, was also involved in the screenplay. So I'm wondering, how is the writer who's also involved in the screenplay, how does he drop the ball so much from a book he wrote?
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty hard to, I guess, translate some big ideas to screen. I think, maybe, I don't know. I haven't done that process, so I'm not sure. But He also wrote I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Yeah.
Now, that's a movie I don't like, because I don't understand it.
I love that movie because I understood that movie. Yeah.
So I guess maybe he's just a writer who he has his people who get it, and then the people who don't get it. But there's another writer who, speaking of Paul, Normal People, the writer of that book.
Yeah.
The adaptation from book to screen was perfect. Like, it was really great. Well, not, I mean, as perfect as you can get in terms of, like, an on-screen adaptation of anything. Like, it was really, really good. That they made a second show based off her first book, and that show sucked. So it's like, sometimes you can get it right and sometimes you can get it wrong. I guess it just depends on, like, a number of factors that maybe has something to do with you and maybe it doesn't. I don't know, but I just feel like, because the thing is, like, I can see this story being really good. It's just that there were just some key flaws in it that made it not as enjoyable to watch, and, like, for my opinion, just really confusing. And I don't know how I was supposed to really respond to it. Like, I responded to the characters because I like the actors, you know what I'm saying? So it's not the characters on their own. I don't really have any, like, I have empathy for them a little bit more Hen than Junior, but, like, in terms of, like, do I really care about what happened to these people? Not 100%. Not really. I only care because of the actors. So I feel like they had that card up their sleeve. They were like, we know what the people want, so we'll give it to them. But, like, yeah.
I really didn't like anybody in this movie at all. Like you said, the actors, because they do this weird, like, homoerotic bait and switch between Paul and Aaron's characters. They also play it as though Aaron and Saoirse's character are having an affair. Mm-hmm. So you the whole time, I'm really on the side of, like, I'm on Paul's side this whole movie the whole time, like, robot Paul. Robot Paul's like, I love my wife. I ain't trying to go to escape. He's bad, sentimental. She's forcing him out. She might be cheating on him. The science space guy might be trying to come on to him as well in this weird thing, you know, and then it finds out he's a robot. Like, the person I was most concerned about in this project, who was being, like, psychologically abused the whole time, is not the human. Like, his character is the only person I cared about. But I don't want to take it back too far. I know you were just talking about how he's a writer, and you mentioned I'm Thinking of ending things. Which is weird, because he was involved with the writing for this movie. But with the adaptation for I'm Thinking of Ending Things, Charlie Kaufman did all the directing and the writing himself. So I think maybe it's one of those cases where I'm the writer, I want full input on how, you know, the project goes. And it's kind of like I'm going to rewrite something I wrote kind of things. And end up making it worse. That's how I visualize it. maybe he gets it right with the next project, because he has another book called We Spread, I think, which is also being turned into a film as well. So hopefully, you know, maybe he's not involved in the writing process for the screen adaptation and it works out fine, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Because him and the director, Garth Davis, wrote this together. Yeah. So I'm like, I guess we won't know who had the lion's share of duties on that. So we don't know who was really making the decisions. But there is, to me, like, there is good stuff in here. So I'm not going to write it off completely.
Yeah.
I will say the cinematography was beautiful. I loved how everything looked. But in terms of like the actual story, it was tough to get through. And the thing is like, we just watched The Creator, which is basically about a couple and AI. Like we're in that phase of movie making where we were talking about AI a lot because that was happening. And I will say, I still like this movie better than The Creator. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, The Creator. But it's interesting because when I was watching, I was looking at the reviews for this film and they are not good. I think someone on Reddit said that like they were watching it at New York Film Festival and like somebody was laughing while they're watching it. And I don't think they were laughing with enjoyment. I think they were laughing at the film.
Oh, I've done that plenty of times.
So it's not good. And I feel like you were saying earlier, we were like searching for this movie. We couldn't find it. The rollout was so weird and like sketch. Like they said it was coming out in the state and it didn't come out. And everything around this movie is a little bit funky. So I'm not totally sure what to make of it. Like even when I was like logging on Letterboxd, I had nothing to say because I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like I still don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out.
This is one of those movies where if, you know, luckily I didn't pay to watch it because I'd have been so disappointed. Luckily I was able to like pause and stop. Mm-hmm. Like at certain points I just was like, this movie is like not it. And I was like looking at my phone and I was like, how long do I have left? Ooh. Like, and I wanted to like this movie so bad because, you know, I watched Garth Davis's movie Lion, which, you know, stars Dev Patel. That was his debut project, and it's like, it seems to me like Garth does really well with like biographical style pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he did Lion and he did Mary Magdalene, and now he did Foe. But then I worried because now he's also, I guess he's the lead director for the new Tron movie and a bunch of other movies. I'm trying, like I said last week, there are some directors who fit a genre really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like biographical style pictures is probably where Gareth might need to, you know, stay at. But there's nothing wrong with being you find a format as a creative that you work well. Mm-hmm. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Sometimes it's not good. Everybody always says think outside the box. Sometimes stick to what you know. You know, status quo, word to High School Musical, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like this, what to me was like a long Black Mirror episode.
Yeah.
Not the Black Mirror episodes that really stick in your head. Like the ones, just the like the ones like in the middle. Like you have like the really crazy episode, like, and then that one episode in the middle, and then the other episode where you're just like, oh my god, it's like that.
Like episodes like 3 and like 5 until you get to like episode 7 and 6.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it felt like, because there were moments in here that were like genuinely disturbing, like the fact that everyone is lying to this this poor AI who has no idea what's going on, and he gets tortured and killed. Like that scene, first of all, Paul, eat that up. Like I was feeling something, but the rest of the movie, I was just like, this is so weird. So, yeah, I don't fully agree with all of the negative criticisms, but I do see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So.
I don't think this movie is worth, like, the 23 it has on Rotten Tomatoes, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it's that bad. Yeah.
I don't think it could, like, there's, like, you mentioned Old. Like, Old had, like, zero good elements about it. There is a wonderfully good story in this project, like the dissolution of marriage. You have Paul's AI who thinks he's actually human. He's in love with his wife. You have the wife actually in love with the robot. You have all those elements for a good movie there, but it's just somewhere in the middle of it, Gareth and Ian just did not make everything work the way it should have flowed perfectly.
Yeah. Yep. That's it.
Yeah. Moving on from that, heading to the news. First off, of course, we did preview, I guess, a bit about the strike being over and how everything is back on basis. I kind of figured the strike was going to end because, like, 2 days before, like, the industry was announcing, like, new seasons of shows that got picked up for second and third and fourth seasons. So, but Fran Drescher was scolded by namesayers and contrarians as she defended the SAG-AFTRA deal. She said, sadly, there are some naysayers who have exploited this momentum of ours. She said that throughout negotiations, some people have tried to tear down what was being done in the negotiating committee. She went on to say the negotiating team reached a tentative deal last Wednesday that ended the union's 188-day strike. And she said the union's national board voted to approve the deal on Friday by 87%. And now it's on for individual members to ratify. She said the ratification process started this past Monday, and there are about 1,000 questions, and they're going to continue to hold meetings based on the deal.
Yeah. So an actor had brought up some issues that she had with the deal. And Fran was like, this is happening on social media. Like, don't even pay attention to it. Blah, blah, blah. And it was really based around AI and, like, the fact that there are protections against it. But obviously it doesn't go as far as, like, saying no AI, because they were saying, Fran and Duncan, who were the chief negotiators, were saying, like, there was no deal that would have ever come out with us having no AI as a part of our industry. Like, it was going to happen. It's going to happen. So let's try to do what we can and put protections so actors aren't, like, being taken advantage of by this new technology. So I understand how people can feel, like, really passionately against the threat that AI poses to their jobs. Like, yes, it's a very real thing that could definitely happen. So I get their frustrations over it. However, I also understand, like, you're trying to make a deal so people can, a deal that not only protects them, but gives them some leverage, that gives them some more money, some more protections, and that they can get back to work. Like, it's been 118 days. People were having to, like, pick up second jobs and stuff. Like, it was rough on everyone. So, like, I think you kind of have to, you know, be the mature person in the room and say, we're not going to get everything that we want, but let's try to get as much as we can done here so that people can go back to work. And I think that's fair. Like, maybe in 3 years they can negotiate for something else, they can negotiate for something more, but I feel like right now and I don't know all the details of what's in the deal either. I don't know. With the WGA, there were, like, I saw, like, plot points, like, PowerPoints of, like, actually what was in there. I haven't really seen that with this, so I have to do some more research. But,
Yeah, the only thing I think they revealed was part of the AI issue, because that was the one everybody is most aware about. Mm-hmm. What they said is they sought broad protections against the use of AI to create digital replicas without actors' consent or consent or compensation. The final deal includes many provisions that the union demanded, but not all. The main one is the AI models will be allowed to be trained on actors' performances and create synthetic Frankenstein characters, basically taking this actor's eyes, this actor's mouth, nose, and bits and pieces. But the actors will still have final consent and say, hey, if you're using my nose, you need my consent, or whatever. And for a while, Tyler Perry did announce, and Tyler Perry is, like, one of those weird, like, multi-hyphen creators, but he's also not a fan of the unions at all, whether it's writers or actors. Like, we could kind of see from his projects a bit. particularly the Writers Union. He said he didn't agree with what the SAG was doing because we have negotiators are going to come again in 3 years. We shouldn't aim for everything all at once. And at the time, I said, oh, Tyler Perry is being an asshole. But then sitting down and think of it, like, he is kind of right. You kind of going for everything the one time is not going to happen, especially we have a lot of people down the line who now the strike has affected other people who work in production, you know? So I think what Fran and what they negotiated was the best option at the time was get it done piecemealed. As we go on, like, okay, we got this much this time, we got 3 years. Let's work to get what we want in 3 years and that kind of thing. So I think they took the best offer that they could have taken at the time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think what I had thought during not only this strike but the riot strike was like, yeah, you're not gonna get everything, so just try to get what you can. There was a lot of issues at stake because obviously streaming and that all of that had changed the industry so much that it was like, we have to like foundationally restructure stuff. And I think their point of view as negotiators were like, if we don't get the stuff now, then it's going to be harder to negotiate in 3 years. So that's why I think they were fighting so hard for a lot of the big stuff, because they were like, if we don't do something on this now, then we're never going to be able to really have an impact on it later. So like, I think the conclusion is that this was the best outcome. And so obviously not everything's going to be perfect, but I think that this is the best that we can do in this period. So let's just accept it. I don't know. I'm not a part of the union, so I can't really say my opinion on this is like, does not matter because I'm not an actor. But from a distance, that's my, anyway, on to our next story. Warner Brothers reverses course on Coyote vs. Acme after filmmakers rebel. The move gave some creatives pause. They said, I don't know how you see the movie and then go, that couldn't happen to me. And the thing is that like, they shelved Batgirl and they shoved Scooby-Doo Holiday Hunt, I think, last year. And I guess the feeling amongst the people who work with Warner Brothers or have films that are distributed by them is that like, well, they can just see the movie and say, no, we're not going to do it. Now, Warner Brothers has given these filmmakers the option to just shop their movie somewhere else. And they're going to, you know, just accept it as a tax write-off. But I just feel like, yeah, like that's such a uncertain and insecure way to make movies, because it's like, you'd never know if your movie's going to be the one or your product's going to be the one that just gets completely shelved.
Yeah. And I think what made the, like, if you were online at the time on Twitter, like, you saw everybody involved with this project, like, speaking out. You saw the composers with the choir putting behind the scenes clips. You know, they had, I think one of the ADs put a clip of Will Forte falling in a pool and popping out saying, oh, that's how you do a Texas switch. And stuff like that. They were all talking about how much this movie, good this movie was, you know. John Cena mentioned how he was disappointed. And the thing with this project is, this movie was being helmed by James Gunn. The man Warner Brothers just went to head up their DC Films division, and it also brings John Cena in as well in this movie. They're coming off Peacemaker and Suicide Squad, two projects that made them, you know, a lot of success for Warner Brothers. So now you're telling a person in charge of one of your tentpole properties as far as DC goes, yeah, this movie you made, we don't like it, and we're gonna shelve it. So now you have that worm in this guy's ear, like, oh, I'm responsible for the next 10 years of your projects. Is this what's gonna be like going forward? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's so incredible to me how they don't understand, like, why don't you let people judge for themselves whether they like it or not before you just completely shove everyone's hard work and just toss it down the drain. Like, it's such a bad business model of like how to work with creatives, like no one can put their faith in you because they don't know if their movie is going to get seen or not. Like, because you're making those final decisions of whether it's even going to come out or not. It's just like, it's just such a bad way to deal with this. Like, I don't know.
And I, and like, and it's another thing, because we saw how bad the Flash was. And I remember watching a podcast or reading news about the amount of people like were shocked at how soon Blue Beetle went on to streaming after it got released, like almost like a week after, 2 weeks after it went to theaters, they went put on streaming. But the amount of reaction from Blue Beetle, everybody was like, oh, how did this get such a short run? This movie's amazing. They should have scrapped the Flash. They should have given us Batgirl and Blue Beetle. Like these, like I don't like Zaz and everybody else, upper management at Warner Brothers, I don't think they have any idea what people want. And somebody brought up the interesting point that David Zaz took Animal Planet and Discovery, two projects that were solely dedicated to nature and documentaries all the time, and turned them into like reality TV show properties, you know, which is totally counter to what those things are. You know, Dave was probably trying to latch on the trend of, you know, reality TV, and that's why Discovery Animal Planet took that direction. But in chasing the dollars, you lost something. And we see that now, you know, the issues Warner Brothers had trying to catch up with Marvel, and we'll talk about Marvel later on, but now they've stumbled. So there needs to be a whole corporate restructure at the top of Warner Brothers, or they're not going to have any directors or any creators here who want to work with them.
Exactly.
Like I mentioned a while ago, so of course, the big superhero project that released this past week was Captain Marvel, or the Marvels. Apparently, it's underperforming in the box office with the MCU's lowest box office for the weekend domestically. It opened to an estimated $47 billion, and people are saying that's a catastrophe, saying it's less than half of Ant-Man, Quantumania, and Guardians of the Galaxy. And they say it's shocking because Captain Marvel made over $1 billion. But I think what played negatively into this, like, of course, the constant pot limit on Marvel products. You know, you have to watch, you know, you have to watch what? You have to watch a bit of Guardians of the Galaxy, the first movie, to understand what's happening. This one, you have to watch Captain Marvel, you have to watch a season of Miss Marvel, and you have to watch a season of WandaVision. You kind of have to watch too many things to be up on what's happening, and that honestly seems like work. But also, I think the lack of promotion effect is, like, remember, Barbie and Oppenheimer were able to do as well as they could is because they were the only two projects during the two-week pause before the strike started that were heavily promoted. Warner Brothers said, yeah, I'm not going to let this movie fail. We're going to promote these projects out the ass. And they did so. Whereas Disney really did the bare minimum to promote the Marvels. So.
Well, and they, yeah, that is true. And also, you can't really do that much without your actors, and the actor strike just ended. So I feel like the Marvels was collateral damage. I feel like it was like one of the things that were just going to get lost in the sauce of Marvel just being in a really bad place and people just being completely over it. And again, because it's a theatrical debut, it's not, you don't have the kind of leverage that you would have with like Loki, where you can actually watch it at home. So there's more, it's easier to access it. You don't have to go anywhere or do anything. You can just sit there and watch it at your leisure, where with the Marvels, you would have to get up, go buy a ticket, you know, go to the movie theater. And I don't know if people were really motivated to do that just because of the state that Marvel's in. There were already, and I guess also, I don't know if Nia DaCosta's comments helped a ton in terms of hyping this movie up. It seemed very much of her being like, and it like really being a cog in, you know, the Marvel, the MCU wheel. So there wasn't a lot of love to kind of prop this into a place where it would have been successful. And then on top of that, you're not the actor strike just ended, so they couldn't even promote it. So it was like, and again, to what you said, it's like you would have had to have watched all of those other things in order to understand where we were at in this portion. But also because the MCU is so disjointed and without any focus, it's almost like where does this even fit? Why are we even investing in this movie in particular when all the other movies have been almost like, you know, their own solo things that are somehow related? And then this movie, again, is supposed to set up something that's happening later. I was watching a few things earlier today where they were saying the only MCU project that people are actually excited for is Deadpool 3. So, and that's not even finished filming. So, I guess everything else, you know, Loki did well, but like, again, that's a character that we've known for a long time. So it's not like you're really there. I don't know if there's not like a jump people really have to do to get into that. It's like, we're there. But I just feel like if the thing that people are most excited for isn't even out yet, that means that everything else is going to kind of fall by the wayside. So, yeah, I feel bad for the girls, but.
And it's not even that. I think the thing with Loki as well, Loki was designed to also set up, you know, the future projects with Jonathan Majors and Kang going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as all the other multiversal style projects, Loki in itself is, I just got to watch Loki. And that's it. I don't have to do any other work. And to Nia DaCosta, her comments, like, I feel like it's unfair. I think people are attacking her because she's a woman and she's a black woman, particularly directing this project. People are saying when you go woke, you go broke. People forgot Black Panther, black movie, black director. Both movies did over $1 billion. Black Panther 1 and 2. Particularly surprisingly, with Black Panther 1 also dealing with the loss of Chadwick Boseman, your lead character, that second movie was able to recover and do just as well as the first one. Mm. So don't make this about race and woke BS. No. Yeah, and secondly, her comments about not wanting to be a cog in the Marvel system, Edgar Wright said those same things before Marvel removed him from Ant-Man.
Mm.
You know, so why wasn't his comments an issue about not wanting to be a cog in Marvel system when he was doing Ant-Man? But now that it's a woman director with three female leads, now it's a big thing. And yes, plenty of directors leave projects in the middle of the thing. And people are saying this is her first, here's her directorial debut. This is not her directorial debut. Y'all idiots need to go watch Candyman. That was a wonderful reimagining, readaptation of that movie. Probably better than the other. Like, after the first Candyman, that movie's on par with the first one. That movie's wonderful. Like, so I do think there's a tinge of racism and misogyny in people's reaction as to why this movie is doing bad, beyond the lack of marketing. So
yeah, and there's always going to be a little bit of that, isn't it, when it comes to anyone who's not white and who's not male making a movie. And I wasn't trying to say any of that. I was just saying, like, it, I guess maybe, I don't know, there's like a million reasons why this probably underperformed. There's a whole bunch of reasons. I think I was just saying, like, if your director doesn't seem like that excited about like the film, and maybe she did, because I haven't watched all of the interviews. I've just read some of the stuff, the remarks that she made. So I could be wrong. There might be a whole bunch of stuff out there where she's like, I loved making this movie and it was great and I had a great time. Like, I don't know. I didn't do my research to see if that's true or not. But I was just saying, like, to be honest, I completely understand and agree with her comments. Like, to me, that makes so much sense. Because I think what Marvel has done, and they haven't been really successful in this. I don't know how Ryan Coogler feels. Like, I don't know if he's ever spoken out about this or not. But they take interesting directors who have done really cool stuff, a lot of independent stuff, and they're like, oh, come over here, do a bigger thing, have a bigger platform, but also conform to how we want things to be done. So it's like, you're not even really giving them room to stretch their muscles artistically, because you are confining them into a box where their project still has to fit in the line of whatever else you're making 3-5 years from now. So I think Marvel actually is the one who's kind of screwing people over, because don't pick really good filmmakers and then not give them like enough runway to actually do what they do. Like, you know what I'm saying? So actually, Marvel's to blame. That's the beginning and the end of this, conversation. It's to blame. It's them.
Yeah. It's Foggy's fault.
It's Foggy's. Honestly. Yeah.
The idea of planning out a roadmap of 20 pictures and hard set the timelines and release dates for these movies creates production hell. That means there are going to be a lot of mistakes and a lot of rush jobs as far as writing and stuff. Like Avengers, the last Avengers movie, they had no idea what the costumes they're going to be wearing for the time travel stuff, what they're going to look like. Mm-hmm. They didn't figure that out till after shooting was done. So those scenes, they're not even wearing that. They're wearing like tracking dots, so they can then do it digitally. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah.
Anyway, the last story.
So
the last story is sorry, go ahead.
You can introduce it if you want to.
You did the last one. That's how we do it. We switch off. Okay, so this last story is about Jacob B. Lordy, and he said that he refused to audition for Superman because he said it was too dark for him, and then he calls the kissing booth films ridiculous and that he didn't want to make them. I want to read the entire article because it seems very interesting, but it kind of it ties into what you watched this week, so I wanted to bring it up. Jacob B. Lordy is a very interesting actor to me, and I feel like he's going to do some really cool stuff. He's already doing cool stuff. Like, he's about to work with Paul Schrader. Like, that's a really cool choice, first of all. But I like the fact that, like, he came in almost kind of a Robert Pattinson way, where he came from a very, like, YA. And listen, The Kissing Booth, those are not good movies. Like, I love you, Joey King, but girly, it's not good. And he always kind of said that he didn't really like doing it. Similar to Rob kind of bagging or like bragging on Twilight. It was a similar vibe. But I like the fact that he said that, well, if I did this for them, then I would be able to kind of have a career that I wanted to. So basically, like, it's like you kind of have to sacrifice a little bit in order to kind of get what you want. I think that's where he was coming from, which I thought was a very smart and true. Like, you know, I think when you look like he does, there's a very like stereotypical pathway that your career can go. And the fact that he's choosing to work with a lot of women, a lot of independent directors, that's putting him in a position where he can actually, I think, be fulfilled creatively. And I'm not saying that Euphoria doesn't do that for him. I think Nate Jacobs is a twisted but interesting character. And I think that, again, was another smart move. But again, that's in high school. There's not much, I mean, I don't know what they're about to do with their season, but that's neither here nor there. I feel like he can really like branch out and do some really interesting things now, instead of, because I feel like what DC and Marvel is doing now is that they're seeing all these young actors and being like, oh, come do Fantastic Four, come do Superman, come do this and that. And it's like, I don't know, this new generation, they're not really down to do like, you know, the studio stuff all the way. Like, it has to be like a really respected director, and it would have to be like something interesting, like Dune or Gladiator. Like, it can't be like a comic book movie, especially because of the place that comic book movies are in right now. It's not in a great place. So I completely respect him for making that decision. I think it was the right call.
I kind of see the direction, like a lot of young Hollywood, like, this crop of actors coming out now is amazing. I'm also going to put some, I'll even put Dev Patel in that group as well. You know, even though he's had a career for a while, like, young Hollywood is on another artistic level.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the precursor to their thinking of projects, I think part of it has to lie with, you know, Scarlett and Chris Evans, because they were actors who were mostly doing, you know, a bit of comedy stuff, a bit of indie stuff, and they got thrust into the superhero contracts, being locked in and being limited creatively, but who are now like doing independent stuff. Like, they had very few chances. Like, Chris did one Broadway project, and he did, you know, of course, he did Snowpiercer, and then, you know, he's seen his stuff with Knives Out when he got those chances. Like, oh, Marvel, you want to renegotiate with me for other movies? I need the freedom to go do projects I actually really like as well. Mm-hmm. So I think these new actors are following that vein. And I'm just going to cut to it, like I'm gonna drop into my earlier view of what I watched. Like, like I had an opportunity to go to an early screening of Saltburn with Barry Keoghan and Jacob Iori, and I walked away. I brought my homeboy with me, and I walked away like, Emma Fennell is on another level as a director. Like, she's two for two with her projects, and I am surprised that Jacob right now to me is looking like the best actor out of that Euphoria cast, and I'm including Zendaya in this. You know, like he is not what I expected to be, particularly coming from the kissing booth. And it's very funny, like, he mentioned how he hated doing that, but in this article, Jamie King has mentioned how he loves that, how she loved that, and how she was willing to stay on. Jamie King was the executive producer for the second one and third one, and she held on to those projects, and look at the way her career has gone. Like, she was in Bullet Train for like 2 minutes. Like, she starred in The Princess, her project, lead project for her, also executive produced, and it got like, it's not that good. Like, you can, like, their careers have taken two jolly drastic different directions based on their decisions in regard to one movie franchise, which is amazing to watch. Like, I feel like Jamie King's thing is like, oh, I'm gonna do these projects so I can make my money, and clearly Jacob was like, no, I want my artistic independence. You know,
well, she wasn't the act, and she did get nominated for an Emmy for that because she's a great actress. She does good stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna push back on that a little bit. I'm saying the
level of
her career has gone down the drain because
I'm gonna say gone down the drain, but
kissing with
I'm saying their exposure. Like, she was
also she's also been acting since she was a child, so it's a very different situation.
Yeah. But still, I do think I'm surprised at the very drastic directions. Like, he's taken a lot more high profile projects in comparison to her out of that, you know, that project. So, but yeah, I'm impressed. Like I said, like, he is like, he, like, him, Kevin Harrison, like, those, like I, you have to include Timothée Chalamet. Like, this crop of young Hollywood is like they're on another level. Like, people like to hold on, like, ideas of, like, Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. Like, no, there's a bunch of talented young actors who are, like, coming for the throne for them. And that's also probably why Ben Affleck switched more to directing now. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm loving my crew because I think we're all the same age. So, I love the kids. Like, they're doing great stuff. But since we're already in our weekend recommendations, I will just put that in there about what I watched. So I finished watching The Morning Show season 3. Interesting season. I thought it was pretty good. It kind of deals with like corporate type, like tech bros and corporate tycoons kind of moving on like legacy media stuff, which I thought was interesting and probably already happening. It actually already has happened because of Elon Musk took over Twitter, but whatever. I thought the performances were good. I still think that Jennifer Aniston is the best actor on that. Like, I love Nicole Beharie, but she didn't get like that much stuff to do. Jennifer Aniston, great actor. I want to see her in more stuff. But I feel like the show is very weird. Like, they'll have episodes that are so good, and they'll have episodes where it's just like, what is this? So I kind of want this show to end. Like, I really don't want in season 4 of this. I know they're going to make one, but let that be the last season, because the show does not need to continue. I feel like it did everything that it needs to do. Loki season 2, finished that. Thought it was great. I actually like season 2 more than I like season 1. And I feel like out of all the mess of the MCU this year, like, this and Guardians 3 was probably like the best offerings that they were able to give us out of this year. And I feel like they have at least an idea of where they're going through the Loki series. And also, someone else said this, but Tom Hiddleston is just like one of the best actors in that entire MCU crew. Like, you got Benedict Cumberbatch and people of that nature, but like, honestly, and he's also been doing it for so long. So we've been able to see like his growth through the character, and he really is just the best. Like, he brings so much to the show, and I love him. I love Owen Wilson. I thought they were great together. It's really good. I'm not going to spoil it. Just watch it. And you'll know what I mean. And I finally finished The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Mm.
I finally finished it. I was like, I'm going to finish this movie if it's not the last thing that I do. And you know how much I hate musicals. And so it was really hard. Like, it was so difficult for me to get through this movie. Because it's not like there is like scenes and then they break out into song. It is everyone sings their lines like throughout the entire movie. It's just singing, like, just, and then all of the songs sound very much the same. So it's not even like we're getting different genres or anything. It's just, it drove me absolutely crazy. But I finished that joint. I did it. I will say that, like, I think her name is Catherine Deneuve, if I'm not, yeah, her. A very beautiful woman. And I thought that she did a great job in this. Obviously, like, I mean, it's from the, like, 50s or 60s, but, like, she was really good. The story is kind of, like, you know exactly what's going to happen, so it's not that interesting to me. But the production design is amazing. I loved how everything looked. I loved how everything was shot. She was nice to look at. The guy was nice to look at, so that kind of held on. That kind of kept me going a little bit. The fashion was amazing. The hair and makeup, loved it. So, like, it was giving something. It was just, I am not the target audience for that kind of movie, but it's important in, like, cinema history or whatever. So I did watch it and finish it. And honestly, it was fine. That's my review. It was fine.
Look, we gotta do another old Hollywood movie. I gotta torture you a bit. So far,
you know, some that I really like I love Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I mean, yeah, your Audrey
Hepburn. Well, I love anything that she does, yeah. Really, but, and I love other older movies, and then, but there are some that just, you know what, I actually really liked Casablanca. The issue was, I just didn't understand why everybody was so obsessed with it. That was my question. I was like, what is it about this film? Like, that's the only thing. It's not like I didn't enjoy it. I did. I'm gonna try and crack Breathless, another Godard film. And after Masculine and Feminine, I feel like I'm gonna struggle through these movies, but I'm gonna do it. That's my challenge over this Christmas break. I'm gonna crack it.
Well, I already got my Christmas holiday tradition of watching Meet Me in St. Louis with my mom. That's our go-to, you know, right, holiday, you know, classic movie, you know. Yeah,
okay, well, awesome talking. Now that's it for us this week. We hope you're taking care of yourselves and doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media, support us if you can, and we will see you in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir.